From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In his new book, Return to Greatness, How America Lost Its Sense of Purpose and What It Needs to Do to Recover It, Alan Wolfe sees an America where partisanship trumps real patriotism, where knocking opponents down matters more than building up the country. Tonight on Point, the good, the great, and America's shifting sense of itself with Alan Wolfe. We begin tonight with news from the Arab League summit in Algiers. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan met with Syria's President Bashar al-Assad at the summit today and reported that Damascus says it will withdraw from Lebanon in keeping with a Security Council resolution. But members of the Arab League deplored international pressure on Syria. Hassan Fatah is a correspondent for the New York Times and is at the summit. I asked him to explain what the Arab League is doing about the situation in Syria and Lebanon.
Well, the reality is they're taking many different steps over the next 2 days. They began this morning deliberations. One of the steps was actually to show some support to Syria. It was not actually a formal recommendation per se, as much as it is basically lip service to Syria.
And is this a rejection of international pressure on Syria to pull out of Lebanon?
I don't think it has anything to do with actually the pressure to pull out, as much as it is about the isolation of Syria over the past month, or over several months, in fact.
But there was talk of rejecting any further what was called foreign intervention in Syria's promised pullout from Lebanon. Is that aimed at Europe, at the United States?
It was essentially a rejection of meddling by the U.S., France, and others who have been involved in the entire issue over the past several months. Essentially, the Arab League was emphasizing that this is an issue between Lebanon and Syria alone, and others should not get involved.
Is the Arab League suggesting that Syria should, must pull out, or not?
They, in fact, are still encouraging Bashar al-Assad to continue this pullout and continue to get troops out of Lebanon.
Hassan, what else is at the top of the agenda there in Algiers with the Arab League?
Well, the more interesting thing is, as I was starting out today, is an attempt at restarting the peace initiative. Over the weekend, an initiative that was proposed by Jordan King Abdullah was actually turned down.
This is a peace initiative around the Israelis and Palestinians.
Yes, exactly. It was basically suggested that the Arabs would effectively normalize relations with Israel, with the idea of continuing to negotiate to form Palestinian rights and that sort of thing.
And the Arab League has rejected that. Why?
That proposal was turned down wholeheartedly, in fact, on the basis that Israel must first be willing to pull out of the occupied territories before any further discussion can happen.
Back to the pre-1967 borders, and of course, that looking unlikely. Let me ask you, Hassan Fatah, you're talking with people there in Algiers. What about the big American vision of a Middle East transformed by a democracy movement? How's that being discussed, received, perceived there?
Well, in essence, there's not much discussion going on within the hall itself. Remember that the Arab leaders sitting in the hall are the people that would be the biggest losers of this kind of initiative and are facing the most pressure. So they've avoided a very much discussion of those issues for this year.
Because they would be losers representing, many of them, non-democratic governments. What about the war in Iraq and the status of Iraq's progress? How's that being discussed?
Well, they've stood with Iraq, and there have been several calls to help in bring about stability in Iraq. It's essentially a hands-off motion, but a very important one as well.
The interim president of Iraq, Ghazi al-Yawar, is there. So you're saying he's getting a supportive reception from the Arab League, not seen as a puppet of outsiders, but as a government deserving of support?
Certainly. I think that he's been getting much more support than he might have otherwise. I think that the elections have certainly helped with that atmosphere. I also think that whatever hard feelings there may have been about the war itself have largely dissipated.
What about American standing overall? Do you have a sense from the conversations in the corridors there, Hassan Fatah, how the invasion and subsequent events in Iraq have affected America's clout in the Middle East with this gathering?
Well, I don't think it's just the invasion, but it's about a whole series of steps that the Bush administration is taking that makes a lot of people here very uncomfortable and relatively unhappy with the role that America's playing. Many here feel that it is just too aggressive and is trying to push for things that don't necessarily belong in that sphere. That's one of the things that continues to come out. Another thing that comes out in a lot of the discussions here is the seeming inability of the Arab League itself to create much dramatic change and build a quorum. That's a very difficult thing for an organization like this, and a step that's very similar to the UN and criticism that the UN has been facing over the past several years.
A few years ago, Donald Rumsfeld talked about an old and new Europe. Do these Arab League representatives have the sense that they're being boxed into a status as the old Middle East by Washington?
I think that they feel that they're in the crosshairs consistently, and there are some who are trying to push for change and encouraging their colleagues to begin to change their ways, and there's others who want to hold on to what they've got. And in many ways, today's opener, you found essentially an attempt to stick with the status quo.
Hassan Fateh in Algiers, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Hassan Fateh is a correspondent for the New York Times. He spoke with me from the Arab League Summit in Algiers, Algeria. In the name of the good, charges my guest tonight, political scientist Alan Wolf, the Republican Party embraces extremism, while the Democratic Party, he says, is too lost in everyday details to even have a vision to embrace. And no one, he says, is today pushing the country to real greatness. Tonight on Point, America's sense of itself, of the good, of the great, and of America's role in the world. You can join the conversation. What path do you see America on in the era of George W. Bush? A path to goodness, to greatness, or something else? Is the United States today a great nation? How do you define greatness? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me tonight in the studio is Alan Wolf. He's professor of political science and director of the Boisy Center for Religion and American Public Life at Boston College. His past books include The Transformation of American Religion, How We Actually Practice Our Faith, One Nation After All, and Who's Keeper? Social Science and Moral Obligation. Fans of Alan Wolf say he changes the way we think about the world. His new book is Return to Greatness, How America Lost Its Sense of Purpose and What It Needs to Do to Recover It. Alan Wolf, good evening. Welcome to On Point.
Thanks, Tom.
Talk about a title of a book with a great big agenda, How We Lost Our Sense of Purpose, What We Need to Do to Recover It. You can't get much more ambitious than that. You put forward a kind of whole theory of the moment here, and I applaud your ambition in doing that. I guess a lot of us are looking for that. How do you describe the moment that the country is caught at here, cut off from greatness?
Well, I should say it's a big theme, but it's actually a very short book. It's an essay. It's an attempt to provoke. It's an attempt to really go back throughout the American experience and look at two competing visions that we as Americans have had. One, a kind of idea of a redeemer nation, that we're charged with God with a special purpose to promote virtue in the world. An idea that has Jeffersonian roots, roots in Andrew Jackson, roots in the isolationists of the 20th century. And then an idea that we can really be a great society, a cosmopolitan society, a real world force. An idea that has its roots in Alexander Hamilton, in the great Justice John Marshall, in Abraham Lincoln, and in the two Roosevelts, and probably was last heard in the Kennedy-Johnson years.
And you describe these as very distinct, as tying down to distinct roots. You say, Alan Wolf, that the biggest stumbling block to greatness lies in the American passion for goodness. That's not necessarily intuitive. Please explain what you mean.
Well, you know, one would think if these are wonderful things, let's be good and great at the same time. But no one's ever really been able to do that. The one American president who really tried, who both had a kind of conception of America as a righteous place and a conception of America as a great nation, was Woodrow Wilson. And he was really sort of torn apart by his competing sense. Greatness means that you have to have an active government. You have to have a centralized political power. You have to have a sense of a common purpose. You have to do politics in a real serious, you'll forgive me, almost a European way, a kind of Germanic way, a tradition of realpolitik. You have to be pretty ruthless about it. goodness means that you basically turn your backs on the world, and especially on a place like Europe, which has always been seen by the goodness school as corrupt and aristocratic and old world and so on. It really is a conflict. You've really got to choose one or the other. And, you know, I basically come out against goodness. I mean, I really think politics is about our collective life as a nation. And as a political scientist and as someone concerned about this country and its direction, I think we're better off trying to pursue greatness than trying to achieve goodness.
And of course, these terms sound like they get us in trouble. But when you come out against goodness, you come out against the George W. Bush administration quite strongly.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the neoconservatives like David Brooks and William Kristol, who really started this conversation about American greatness, and I'm very indebted to them for starting it. They originally put their money on John McCain, who I also admire. When Bush took over the Republican Party and won the presidential nomination and then the presidency, he set back the cause of greatness. Conservatives will never now be in favor of greatness. That's my view. Only liberals can. The liberal tradition has more resources. And in particular, the liberal tradition has this sense of ourselves as a common entity, whereas in the conservative idea of the world, it's laissez-faire. It's everyone for themselves. I still believe that isolationism is the major streak in the foreign policy of the Republican Party. I see Bush as embodying really almost in an amazing way every negative feature of the quest for goodness that's ever been arisen from Jefferson to Jackson to the president, and all putting them in one presidency.
Okay, don't mince words, Ellen Wolf. We've got it. There's a liberal on deck tonight. He's got a big critique here, a big sort of theory of the moment we're at about America's sense of itself. Ellen Wolf's new book is Return to Greatness. You can join the conversation tonight. What path do you see America on in the era of George W. Bush? Toward greatness, toward goodness, toward something else? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about America's sense of itself, of the good, of the great, and of America's role in the world. My guest is Alan Wolf. His new book is Return to Greatness, How America Lost Its Sense of Purpose and What It Needs to Do to Recover It. You can join the conversation tonight. What do you think? Does greatness flow from ideological purity or flexible pragmatism? And what is a great nation? Is the United States a great nation now? When has it been? And who comes closer to describing your idea of national greatness, Alan Wolf or George W. Bush, the president? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Okay, you've got us going here, but we're gonna have to work on this some more, because the idea that goodness is somehow the wrong path to go down remains, I think, counterintuitive to many people. And what I hear you describing here, where you're saying goodness is about self-righteousness. Let's get back to a very active central government and not be so concerned about all that goodness stuff. This sounds like it sets you up for the classic sort of conservative critique, which is, Alan Wolf, you're in favor of big government and moral squalor, and we're done with all that. So is that what greatness means to you?
Oh, yeah, to take the bull by the horns, it certainly means an active government, probably a big government. We are a funny society, the United States. We were not created as a nation state the way other countries were. It took us a long time to create a country.
Meaning that we were a geography, an expanding geography, but not a people who then spent
a
millennia
together. That's right. We were regional. To begin with, people would say, I'm a Virginian rather than I'm an American. Then we had this unbelievably horrendous civil war in order to establish the principle of national citizenship. You could say that we really didn't become a nation until the 14th Amendment after the Civil War. But even then, even when we guaranteed national citizenship to all Americans and created a government, we excluded African Americans. In fact, you could say we didn't really become an American nation until the Voting Rights Act of 1965 gave every adult American the fundamental right to vote and to become a citizen of their society.
And you're describing becoming a nation as the critical step toward greatness.
The critical step toward greatness, because a great society includes all of its members, because it's obvious that people are a tremendous resource. People are a source of energy. You want to tap the energies of everyone.
But a lot of people fought for civil rights out of a moral conviction, out of the goodness train.
Absolutely. Although Martin Luther King Jr., who, of course, we always think of in this context, was actually a student of my intellectual hero, who's Reinhold Niebuhr, who I think was the greatest theorist of greatness and was strongly influenced by all the ideas I'm saying. In many ways, I'm simply repeating a lot of Reinhold Niebuhr. And so don't miss this point, Tom, because
yes,
a lot of people
please.
Do. A lot of people do. King knew about the greatness tradition, and he was inspired by the greatness tradition. He's one of the most interesting Americans because he combined elements of both.
Fighting for civil rights, not just because it was the right thing to do morally, but because it would create a greater nation.
It would empower people and give strength to the nation as well.
I think I need you to articulate further what you mean by greatness. Again, you're setting goodness up. You're putting a kind of negative connotation. You're saying it leads us into small-minded kind of politics and self-righteousness. So what is greatness in positive terms?
Greatness in positive terms is taking one of two, one or both, and I prefer both, of America's two great founding ideas, the idea of liberty and the idea of equality, taking them seriously, not just asserting them, not just rhetorically saying, oh, we're a free country, but actually trying to transform liberty and equality into real-world things that really give people the freedom to choose, that really give people a sense of equality. That, in turn, requires a nation state, a political agency that can realize those objectives. And then thirdly, besides having the ideal and realizing it, you need to have the confidence to believe in those ideals abroad and to be willing to project American power abroad in defense of those ideals. Those three things, liberty and equality, the means to realize it, and the willingness to project it abroad, that's what makes America great. That was Teddy Roosevelt's program. That was Abraham Lincoln's program. That was Franklin Delano Roosevelt's program. And in its own way, that was John F. Kennedy's program.
Okay, let's look at what the conservatives say, though, because, of course, they say that this is what they're doing. They're taking American ideals, and they're asserting them abroad. William Kristol, of course, is with the Project for the New American Century. Right on their website, it says, American leadership is good for both America and the world. They believe that this is dedicated to the proposition that such leadership requires military strength, diplomatic energy, and commitment to moral principle. Do you have a problem with that?
Yes, I do. A political movement that will not even allow Congress to raise the money to put armor on its vehicles, that's so committed to tax cuts and the stingy government that they put our own troops at risk when they deploy them abroad. I'm sorry, Bill Kristol, is not a formula for American greatness.
So they're not putting the means behind
the
proposition there.
No conception of greatness could ever include the kind of tax cuts and the kind of redistribution of income away from ordinary people in favor of the wealthy that we're witnessing. This is a scandal. It's one of the greatest scandals in American history. Sure, anybody can say the words. Bush can talk in his inauguration speech about his wonderful ideals, but this is not an administration that in any way has anything in common with Teddy Roosevelt, with Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln would turn over in his grave 16 times.
But you say that, fighting. There have been elections in Iraq. Let's turn here to Peggy Noonan. Peggy Noonan, Republican speechwriter, away with words always. January 6th, she wrote, the Bush administration has stood for cutting taxes, allowing high spending, she's conceding, and being tough in the world. The Democrats, writes Peggy Noonan, stand for raising taxes, high spending, and being weak in the world.
My book is not a defense of the Democrats. We haven't talked about this yet, but you know, I spent equal time talking about how the Democratic Party has retreated from its ideals of greatness as well. And we can talk about that if you want, but don't sell me Peggy Noonan. As you say, she's a wonderful person with words, but words don't cut it, finally, in politics. I mean, words are certainly important in politics. But when people look back at the Bush legacy, they're going to look back at an administration that devastated the beauty of America, that devastated everything, the beauty of its landscape, the beauty of our people, the sense of national solidarity.
Devastated the beauty of our people? What do you
mean? Absolutely. The sense that we are a collective nation with a collective sense of purpose has been replaced by the most wild, extreme social Darwinism that pits one group against another, that much prefers that we sit there and fight a culture war against each other.
You're on your own, Jack.
Right, yeah, right. Rather than that we unite. I don't know anyone, even among Bush's most fervid supporters, who's proud of America right now, who can really say that George Bush is bringing out the best in our people. He is a negative, tearing down kind of president, and the whole Republican Party behind. I mean, Tom DeLay is worse. We may remember George Bush is one of the more moderate guys after we see what the DeLays are capable of. This is not greatness. This
are you being a philosophy here or just a partisan, Ellen Wolf?
No, I'm not being a partisan because you haven't asked me about the Democrats.
Well, okay, I better hear it. How do they fall short of greatness?
You know, I think in the 1960s was the last time the Democrats had a sense of national purpose. They've gotten afraid. They've gotten fearful. They're afraid of big government as well. I mean, one of the amazing things to me, and I go at great length in this in the book, is how the Democrats have become a kind of 18th century political party.
Meaning?
Well, look at the great persons that we think of when we look back to the Vietnam era, J. William Fulbright. Or look at the person now who seems to embody the conscience of Americans protesting against the war in Vietnam, Senator Byrd from West Virginia. Mm. These are 18th century figures. These are small America types who come out of rural societies, segregated societies, who've had their own flirtation with segregation in the past. When you go out now and you ask Americans on the left, who are the great heroes? They'll talk about Henry David Thoreau, who was a pastoralist. They'll talk about Thomas Jefferson, who distrusted big government. One of the raging ideas on the left is this idea that we should be a kind of small R republicanism, civic virtue, and all of that. When Bill Clinton appointed to the position of Assistant Attorney General, he later withdrew the name, Lanny Guinier, it turned out that her intellectual hero was John C. Calhoun. You know, one of the strongest defenders of minorities and minority rights, in that case, white minorities. Mm. I think the left has terribly lost its way and is afraid of its own shadow.
So you're saying, what is it, put a progressive agenda up on the rails and go like hell for it? I hear you calling to bring back exactly what Democrats have lost on over decades. Big government, you're saying bring it back and put it to great purposes, and moral relativism that appears to have cost Democrats right up through last November's election.
My job is not to tell Democrats how to win office. My job is to ask the American people what they want, what kind of country they want to be. And I think that Americans probably don't want the kind of notion I think would bring out the greatness in them. I don't think they would choose it, not in the mood they're in right now.
You don't think Americans want to be great?
Not now. No. That's why they elected this man. That's why they elected this small-minded, ignorant, narrow man from Texas as their president.
You describe Americans having risen to greatness in the past. Why not now?
Well, I don't know. I think in part the reason is that we're such a changed country, that we've seen such a movement of people to the South and the West, for one thing, and those have not been the regions of our national strength in the past. We were certainly scarred by some of our experiences abroad. We've also had something of a religious revival. I think it can be exaggerated, but we've had something of a religious revival. And I see Americans, and I'm really struck by this in the aftermath of 9/11, as more fearful than anything. The Kennedy-esque sense of hope is completely gone in this country, and it's fear, 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 fear. You know, when the Iranians took our hostages, the Ayatollah Khomeini called us the great Satan. Mm-hmm. He was more willing to acknowledge that we're great, although we're not Satan, but we're great, than we are.
Oh, boy.
You know, we are so fearful. It is such an environment of an unwillingness to bring out the best in ourselves right now. I think it's pretty disturbing.
Ellen Wolf is with us. His new book is Return to Greatness. A million people want to talk to you on the phone. But let me ask you one more question, then I promise we'll turn to the calls. You say that for believers in American goodness, that given a choice between being good and being great, they believe America is better off striving for the good. Now, you're using these terms in a very specific way, but again, it's counterintuitive. What is wrong with striving for being good?
I think as individuals, we should all strive to be good. But I think as a nation, we're talking about a collectivity here to have a national sense of purpose, that there's a real problem when you try to legislate goodness. I mean, look at what's happened with this Terry Schiavo business. I mean, here's a group of people in Congress trying to legislate goodness. There are certain things that you do in your private life and in your religious life and in your personal life. I try to be the best person I can be. I try to be good. But in our collective political life, goodness is a danger. Greatness is not. Greatness has its own dangers, to be sure. But
which are?
We can overextend ourselves abroad. We can get into the kinds of trouble we did in Vietnam by mismanaging our attempts to run the world. As many conservatives say, we can get overambitious at home. We can spend money on the wrong things. Nothing's perfect. But it seems to me that if you want to avoid a lot of the problems that we've gotten ourselves into this country, you ought to do what I suggest in the book, which is the rest of the world has no trouble seeing us as a great country, as a great power. When the President of the United States is given evidence that our troops have tortured people in Iraq, and he says, Americans don't do that, he's probably sincere. In his conception, we're too good to do that. But the rest of the world knows.
There's a photo.
The rest of the world knows that we do these things. And I think we can avoid a great deal of the frequent charge made against Americans that they're totally hypocritical by acknowledging that in aspiring to be great, we're not always going to do good. And accepting ourselves as a power like any other power in history that has its strengths and has its faults.
But that pushes toward
when you say goodness comes first, you don't acknowledge faults. And that's something the rest of the world generally doesn't want to hear. And it doesn't do ourselves any good to think that we're above fault.
Mm. There's plenty on the table to chew on here. Let's begin to bring our callers in. Daniel is calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hello, Daniel. You're on the air.
Hi, and thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
Mr. Wolf, very, very interesting. And so in many ways, I see your argument goes back all the way to the founding, to the very same Federalist, Anti-Federalist argument. And while you stand on one side, I can see myself standing on the complete opposite. In this respect, I'm much more of a Jeffersonian in the fact that I believe that Jefferson was right in that if you let the states decide for themselves as a community, then you will get a better tailored government to each individual area. And I believe that you can have greatness and goodness at the same time. Now, of course, this could be me and my youth being somewhat idealistic. But I see more of a possibility for that there without, you know, Hobbes and his Leviathan.
Daniel, do you think that George Bush is taking the country toward a good and great status?
In some ways, yes. In some ways, no. I think that George W. Bush had some excellent intentions. Now, as a Southerner, traditional Southerner, I am, yes, a Republican, but I tend to lean more, I'm in our silent American majority of moderate. However, I think there are some wrong things that he is doing. And one thing that I would like to point out was I heard it mentioned that George Bush is taking us to a period of isolationism or has an isolationist policy when I really can't see that.
I'm not sure I exactly heard that, but we'll pick it up.
Okay, because, I mean, I personally wish that America would actually move towards an isolationist policy, because when I hear isolationism, I think Monroe Doctrine. I think, you know, you leave me alone, I leave you alone, we're all happy. And I don't see the Bush administration doing that, and I think that doesn't help promote democracy. And when you have disparity inside the nation, it's kind of hard to, you know, sell that your family's the greater family when you're going through a divorce.
Right.
And America's kind of going through a divorce right now. You know, you don't look at you know, North Carolina versus California, you see red and blue. You kind of look at your neighbor, and you. One of the first things you ask is, "Who did you vote for?"
Amen, Daniel. You put a lot out there yourself. Thanks very much for your call from Raleigh. Wow, Alan Wolf, there's a lot you could grab onto there. I mean, Daniel looks to the kind of tradition that you're both tying your thinking back to, and says he just reads it forward differently than you. He's still prepared to aspire to goodness and greatness.
I think he's absolutely right that this does go back to the debates between Jefferson and Hamilton, and Daniel said he leans in the Jeffersonian camp, and I obviously lean in the Hamiltonian camp. But we've been fighting this conception of ourselves for a very, very long time. My point in the book is that Daniel's vision usually wins in this country, that greatness is the default. Greatness is the exception.
The exception. Goodness
is the default. Greatness is the exception. And we're in one of those periods that resonates with earlier periods in American history. Just one point of clarification, if I may. I didn't say that Bush was isolationist. I think the Republican Party is basically an isolationist party. If this were a Democrat fighting this war in Iraq, Tom DeLay would be against every single appropriation. They were when Bill Clinton tried to intervene in other countries abroad. And I actually think it's only a matter of time if things, and I hope they don't, but if things do go wrong in Iraq, before the big pressure to withdraw is going to come from Republicans who don't want to pay for it.
Mm. So many callers, but not enough time before the break. We've got a minute here. Give us your greatness high points in American history. When, in your view, Alan Wolf, was America great?
Well, Lincoln was our greatest president, and Lincoln's words at the Gettysburg Address were one of the greatest moments in American history. Lincoln understood the necessity of holding the country together. Right now, right after 2004, I heard people sort of snickering on the left that, you know, the states that voted for Kerry, maybe they should secede. That's not a good idea, my friends on the left. We're one country, and we're going to remain one country. Teddy Roosevelt was one of our greatest presidents. He was a very flawed man, but he stood for the principle of stewardship. He stood for welcoming immigrants. He stood for protecting the environment. We've had great presidents. I wish we've had more of them.
Alan Wolf's new book is Return to Greatness. You can join the conversation tonight. If liberals are so great, why aren't they in the elected majority? And Alan Wolf says all America's great innovations have been supported by liberal thinking and opposed by conservatives. Do you agree? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about America's sense of itself, of the good, the great, and the American role in the world. My guest is Alan Wolf, political scientist at Boston College, author of the new book, Return to Greatness, How America Lost Its Sense of Purpose and What It Needs to Do to Recover It. You can join the conversation tonight. Is Alan Wolf suggesting to you that big government is necessary for a great nation? Are you on board with that? And I'll ask it again. If liberals are so great, why aren't they in the elected majority? What's your vision of a great American future? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Anne is calling from Gloucester, Massachusetts. Hello, Anne. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I think it's being a true democracy. And the government administration at the moment doesn't really trust democracy. That's why they do so many dirty tricks, which I think is the reason why they happen to be on top at the moment.
Well, they got voted in. That's a kind of democratic success.
Well, the democracy didn't really wasn't really allowed to come through. My daughter voted in Ohio after 5.5 hours of good democratic waiting, and the last voter left standing, I hear, was sometime at 1 or 2 in the morning after 9 hours or so.
And let me ask you, what about this line that Alan Wolf draws between goodness and greatness? Do you buy that? Do we have to choose?
No, of course not. We can't be great without being good. And it's the striving for real goodness that matters. We, of course, nobody's ever perfect in this life, but it's trying.
Anne, stick with us. I'd like Alan Wolf to speak directly to you on this, because, Alan, you don't agree. So have it out with Anne. She says you can't be great without being good. Let's hear you two work this out.
Oh, I don't know that we can, but I'll say that I have no problem with individuals trying to be good, but societies, to be great, have to take a lot of steps that are difficult. They're demanding. They tell us that there are things that we have to do that we may not want to do.
Like supporting dictators in Guatemala.
Oh, I'm talking more even at home. We have to pay more taxes, for one thing. We have to be called upon to sacrifice more for our country. Maybe Ann and I would agree on one thing. I mean, one of the things that's really striking about the Bush administration, probably the most striking thing, is that in this war in Iraq, there's no talk about sacrifice. There's no talk about putting aside your self-interest for the sake of the common good. Those are difficult things to ask.
But you're saying that Americans get taken down a rabbit hole when they try to be good, and Anne's saying, no, we've got to be good as we step into the world.
I think that we should stand for fundamental principles such as liberty and equality. And if that's what we're talking about, then I'm all for it.
Is that enough, Anne, liberty and equality?
Well, goodness is goodness does. And you just try to to do the best you can for your fellow man. And that's what, and government has to make compromises, and it has to, but it has to be aiming to help mankind and to help all of the people.
Is liberty and equality enough? I mean, in the current American debate, those are kind of value-free terms.
Well, they've come out to be words now in the present day that we talk about it and we put we but we don't do it. We do the Patriot Act, which is the most unpatriotic thing, and it's taking a, it's breaking down our democracy, our taking away our Bill of Rights.
Anne, we've got it. We appreciate your call. Thanks very much for being with us. Ellen Wolf, you say you're really tough on this Bush administration. You say it combines the ruthless efficiency of the market with the authoritarian tendencies of the state. It creates a nightmare worse than each by itself can generate.
There's absolutely no doubt in my mind that this is the worst presidency we've ever had in the history of the United States, and that the election, re-election of George W. Bush in 2004 was one of the worst political moments in American history. I hope and pray that Americans will someday be ashamed of what they did by returning this administration to power. It is cynical. It is ruthless. It is bent on transforming Americans into a petty, divided, and hostile society. It appeals to the absolute worst of human emotions rather than the most nobling. Whatever word you will eventually use to describe the Bush administration, the word ennobling, the word enlightened, the word aspiring will never cross your lips. You can talk about its ruthlessness, and I'm second to none in my appreciation of the president's extraordinary political skills. But to talk about this administration as embodying the principles that have made this country great, the unity, the sense of collective destiny, the sense that we share a common project, that we are united as Americans, this is a divisive, partisan, angry, and negative administration, and it appeals to the worst in human nature.
We've got the un-Karl Rove with us tonight in Ellen Wolf. Tom is calling from New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hello, Tom. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you all doing tonight?
We're good. What's on your mind? What do you think?
I was just thinking that some of the greatest things that this country has achieved have been through the people and not necessarily its government. In the mobilization for World War II, that was the people, the men and the women, and the creation of the best NGOs, you know, the Red Cross and the Peace Corps. I'm not that familiar with the histories of those, but it's when the government, it seems to me, it's when the government usurps that goodness for itself that the people become complacent and the government has done some of the worst things in our history, which is happening right now.
Well, you're going to get an argument again, I fear, here from Alan Wolf, but stick with us, Tom. Alan Wolf, I read you saying just the opposite.
Just,
you say that the 15 years ago you put your faith in civil society, in
just
communities, apart from government, stepping up to do the right thing, and it didn't work. You're saying it has to be big government in the end?
That's right. I mean, look at the example that was just raised by our caller about World War II. The fact is Americans didn't want to go to war in World War II, and if it had been left to a kind of popularity contest without strong presidential leadership, Hitler would have triumphed in Europe. It took great leadership on the part of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who coaxed and persuaded and lied and cheated to get the Americans involved in World War II to defeat that monster called European fascism.
So are you applauding democracy or elitism here?
Well, I would certainly think that democracy requires leadership, and that as we saw this weekend with this rush for Congress to pass a law, a democracy that just simply registers public opinion at any given time is no democracy by the whole tradition of leadership. Hamilton, Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt, these were all people who talked about how leadership requires a tutorial function. You don't just read the polls. This is political leadership, and this is what we're sorely missing in this country.
Tom, how about it? Alan Wolf is pushing back. He's saying, no, my friend, you need leadership. You need a wise FDR to get you doing what you need to be doing. Do you buy that?
Yeah. Well, what you also need is a free press, and which I don't know has really existed in the last, if ever, really, maybe in the first 100 years.
So kick it up and ask a lot of questions. Tom, thanks very much for calling in from New Brunswick in New Jersey there. Diego is calling from Methuen, Massachusetts. Hi, Diego. You're on the air.
Hi. It's really great to be able to talk with you. I have to say that I am in agreement with your guest 100%. And my only question is, what can we do in the American conversation to start turning things back toward where we need to go? You know, it's been a dismal time. Reagan, Bush 1, Bush 2, and even a wishy-washy Clinton in between. It's been a tough time for American democracy, and we really are stagnating, and the rest of the world is well advised to stay back from our example because we're not setting the example we once did.
So Alan Wolfe is singing your song tonight, and you want to know what to do about it. It's right there in the book's title. We'll go to it. Diego, thanks for your call. Alan Wolfe, what's the prescription for your kind of greatness?
Well, thanks, Diego, for that lovely comment. That's why I became a writer, to occasionally hear comments like that, and I'm really in your debt. It's a very difficult question. I mean, I think it's... I think it's a funny kind of question because, in a sense, I think we know. I think we know that we have growing poverty in the United States, that we have people without health care. I mean, health care to me is a kind of fascinating issue because in every war we fought and in every effort we fought to make ourselves great, we realized that the health of Americans, the stronger Americans are, the stronger America is. And when you let Americans not have the financial resources to cure their diseases, to be as strong as they can, you're weakening the country. That's why all of our great presidents and great leaders have made healthcare such a high priority. We're going the wrong direction on healthcare. There's absolutely no doubt about that. We're privatizing the system. The president right now is knows. I mean, again, I give Bush credit for some things. He knows that the greatest law ever passed in the history of the United States is Social Security. He knows it, and he wants to destroy it. And he's using every one of his cynical ploys in order to do it, because so long as we have Social Security, we retain part of the greatness tradition in America, that every American counts. And if we abolish Social Security, we abolish greatness.
But Diego is hearing you. He wants you to deliver on your subtitle here, what America needs to do to recover its greatness.
As I was saying, we have the ideas. There's Social Security, there's health care, there's these classes. Classic liberal ideas. The political agenda right now is hostile to them. I'm not a politician. All I can do is write a book. All I can do is go on radio programs.
But the country chose a different direction.
The country has constantly chosen the wrong direction in this sense that its greatness is far too demanding. Greatness requires sacrifice. And yes, we're not going to choose that.
But Americans have in the past.
They have in the past because an amazing thing has happened to the United States, and that is at every great moment of crisis, we have responded with greatness. No one knew that Abraham Lincoln would be a great president. He had a minority vote. He was a backwater guy from Illinois. No one knew it. FDR was thought about as a playboy. We had the Depression. We had World War II, and he responded to it. 9/11 was another opportunity. It was a moment when this not very good man from Texas could have used 9/11 the way that Roosevelt responded to the war, the way that Lincoln responded to the slavery.
The country felt its nationhood in the weeks after 9/11,
The country needed it. Bush was presented with an opportunity to be one of the greatest men in American history. He chose his party before his country. He chose his ideology before America. He chose to divide rather than to unite. One of the reasons why I'm so passionate about Bush is not just because he's a scoundrel, but because he was given an opportunity to make us great, and he chose not to do it. And unfortunately, unlike in the past, when people have responded to this need, we had this man in power at that time, and it is a Greek, a Shakespearean tragedy,
Alan Wolfe,
that this happened.
Do you have a party out there? If the Democrats themselves are so far off track, who do you look to?
Well, I think there are a number of people, and I talk about them in the book. I mean, as I said, I'm a great admirer of John McCain. He has his personal weaknesses. But I think that he had certainly a kind of vision along the lines that I'm describing. I think there are both old-fashioned Republicans and Democrats who have this. I actually do think that we may need some kind of new movement in our political ideas. Our political ideas have become very, very tired. The Republicans, as I said, have been captured by the most extreme elements in American society, and the Democrats are just a bunch of constituency pleasers, and we need some new ideas.
Well, agree or disagree, Alan Wolfe is putting the stick in there tonight. Alan, thank you so much for being with
us. Thank you, Tom. It's been great fun for me.
Alan Wolfe, director of the Boisy Center for Religion and American Public Life at Boston College, author of the new book, Return to Greatness. In a moment, the Red Lake Indian Reservation mourns Monday's deadly school shooting. This is On Point. The Red Lake Indian Reservation in northern Minnesota is still reeling from Monday's deadly school shooting that killed 9 people and wounded 7. The young shooter, teenager Jeff Weiss, also took his own life in the worst act of school violence since the Columbine Massacre in April 1999. Authorities today say it appears Weiss planned the shooting in advance. "Right now we are in utter disbelief and shock," said Floyd Jourdain, Jr., chairman of the Red Lake Chippewa. "This is one of the darkest days in the history of our people." The Red Lake Reservation, home to one of the poorest tribes in the state, is about 240 miles north of Minnesota's Twin Cities. This afternoon, hundreds of tribe members and mourners from throughout the state gathered for a traditional Chippewa prayer service. Here are some sounds from the ceremony.
Grandfather, Great Spirit, I offer the sacred pipe to the east, Grandfather. Will you rise every morning, spend life, open our eyes, and give life to all things here on earth? Grandfather, we ask you to continue with your blessings of all, in all the tribes and nations and those, Grandfather, that are suffering to the east of us, that you look over and watch over each and every one of them.
My grandpas were my mentors. They told me that sometimes, my grandson, times are going to be very hard where you're not going to understand. And this is one of these days that I cannot understand.
And Grandfather, Great Spirit, I offer this pipe to the south. Where the warm winds drift in the springtime and melt the snows and nourish the seeds of Mother Earth and all new life comes about, Grandfather, we ask for your blessings. We ask you to give strength to the families of those loved ones, Grandfather. We offer this pipe to you, Grandfather. You have already sent messengers flying above us to pick up our prayers and take them home for us, Grandfather. And we thank you for this great sign of comfort that you have already given to us today, Grandfather. And that's a special blessing for all of our relatives to the north, those that are suffering, those that are grieving, Grandfather. Relatives here, relatives abroad, relatives are not even here in this country no more, away fighting this war, that have lost loved ones back home, Grandfather. We ask you to comfort them, Grandfather, surround them with your love and strength that we might continue on this journey of life. Grandfather, Great Spirit, we ask these things through this sacred pipe, through this tobacco, the cedar, the sage, the sweetgrass, and the water that you've given us to perform these ceremonies and continue on this red road of life. Nikanagana, 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 all of my relations.
Sounds from the Chippewa prayer service held today to honor the victims of Monday's Red Lake school shooting in Red Lake, Minnesota. Thanks for the recording to Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.